As did many in Chicago, I first became aware of the conductor John Andrea Noseda in an unusual way, and I'm a bit ashamed because he's had, as we're going to talk about, a very interesting, diverse, and busy career for how long as well. I did not, though, become familiar with him from his recordings, which are also diverse and include a lot of interesting and unusual repertoire, as well as some standard works. And it wasn't from a concert. It was actually from a documentary film that our friend Phil Grabsky from England made. And you will remember In Search of Mozart, and then the sequel, in a way, In Search of Beethoven. And not only did John Andrea Noseda figure as a conductor in the film and conducting some wonderful sections of works, but also in both studio and live performance, but also as a commentator. And everybody was saying, wow, this is a really interesting person. And then the folks at the Chicago Symphony said, yes, and we're bringing him to Chicago in 2009, 2010. And so here we are at the beginning of March, and John Andrea Noseda has had a wonderful debut in Chicago, conducting works of Callias Ariajo, conducting with Radu Lupu, leading the Beethoven Third Piano Concerto, and bringing to Chicago for the first time since it was written 115 years ago, the First Symphony of Sergei Rachmaninoff. So with all of that introduction, let me just say it's great to have you finally in Chicago, and I hope that we're going to be seeing you here again.
Thank you very much for your welcome, and I hope so. The meeting with the orchestra has been, from my side, very positive, and the way they got involved in this symphony, which was absolutely unfamiliar for the orchestra, for them, because, as you said before, has been the first time ever in Chicago, they really went for it. They really challenged themselves just to play through the piece and just to catch the atmosphere of the First Symphony by Rachmaninoff. And that has been very rewarding for me because I really like the symphony. Mm-hmm. And so it's been a sort of very good mutual cooperation. And of course, it's been also many debuts in this week for me because it's been my first time I had the possibility to share the platform, the stage with Radu Lupu, which has been always one of my heroes in the piano playing. So that was also another reason of great interest in my professional life and human life. And Callias Ariajo, the piece Orion, has been premiered in Cleveland, but was the first time last week has been performed in Chicago. But I had already conducted this piece Turin. So it's been fun because when the orchestra asked me, we want an opening for this program, Orion by Sariao, do you agree to do that? I said, of course, I already did it. And that was, what?
Well, it probably had two or three performances, yeah. But one was yours. So yeah. So you were in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, that's correct.
Your background is a bit different from a number of your contemporaries, I would say. One, because as I understand it, you came to conducting as a profession a little bit later than some do. Two, you managed to make a very strong connection with a very interesting figure today, Valery Gergiev, and you spent a lot of time in Russia, and you didn't know Russian, I think, when you went there, but you came out speaking it. And then, of course, you also were at Rotterdam Philharmonic in the Gergiev era. So maybe you could take us a bit through how you came to conducting and what it's like if somebody in his 30s feels it's time to move into this profession.
Before I was 30, of course, I got a degree in piano playing. I was a pianist, and I studied composition and everything connected with the music making. So it's not coming out conducting from nowhere, of course. But when I turned 27, the reason for me to start to take lessons as a conductor in the Milano Conservatorium was because I wanted to understand more what is the point of view on the music from the conductor point of view, because it's completely different from the composer point of view or from the piano player point of view. Just to make my musical formation more complete, that was my aim. but came out, let's say, almost by chance. After a couple of years of this, I went to international competition for conductors, and also in that case, I went there just to get experience, sure, just to see how it goes.
Right.
And it turned out I won both competitions. So after the second, not after the first competition, I started to consider the possibility to leave the piano playing, recitals, chamber music, working with the singers. But after the second competition, I really started to consider the possibility, okay, probably this is the easiest way for me to communicate through the music.
But this was the first goal, and still is the goal, yes? Music is the attraction and a way to communicate with it. And initially it was the keyboard, and then maybe it was some collaborations, but then with this affirmation and sense of, oh, maybe this is the way to go, conducting was.
My deepest love has always been music. I try to understand more. And what sometimes makes me feel depressed when I play the piano or when I conduct is the feeling sometimes you conduct a piece, you are convinced you know it. After the performance, you realize your knowledge about the piece is not enough. And that sometimes is causing, not is not a big depression, but the fact when I reapproach, when I reface the piece one more time, I will put again all my energy to try to understand the enigma which is behind the notes in the piece, in the music, try to understand why at a certain point of their life, the composers, felt the need to write something, and probably, without probably, I'm sure I don't have the truth in my pocket, but I try to get closer and closer and closer to the language of the composer and the music, and probably conducting is the more natural, the most natural way to do it.
How then did you come to the attention of Maestro Gergiev?
When I got the degree in conducting in Italy, I decided to attend some master classes because it's important to get deeply more in the subject, just to meet with important conductors. And that summer in 1993 in Siena, in the Accademia Chigiana, which is one of the most important academies of music in Italy, that summer was supposed to be Valery Gergiev, the teacher for this masterclass. And having known later on Valery, I know how rarely he just gives masterclasses. So I've been lucky. So I applied. And of course, I was chosen as one of the students. And Valery Gergiev, Maestro Gergiev, didn't come from the first day. For the first 10 days, he sent Ilya Muzin.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that was not written in the brochure.
Of course,
you know,
not. It's Valery Gergiev.
But but that has been a very wise decision, because just to send them, Ilya Muzin, to us, just prepared the field for Valery to come. So the first 10 days...
So he would come after you all had some basics that you had worked on, some scores, you were ready to demonstrate some things and to learn some insights.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he came for the other 20 days. No, it was 2 weeks. So a big portion of time for Valery Shadow, for Maestro Gergiev Shadow. And I learned a lot of things. And since that point, so summer 93, we kept in contact. He invited me in St. Petersburg in February 94 to attend as a, let's say, young professional, but without conducting, the Rimsky-Korsakov Festival, which took place in St. Petersburg in February. That was my first visit in Russia. And subsequently, I went there for his invitation in January, February 97 to conduct my first opera production, Nozze di Figaro, with the young Ananya Trebko, with young Ildara Brazakov. So that kind of singers, very young, already jewels, but no one out of Russia knew them.
Right.
I had also the privilege to work with this kind of people.
I mean, you really were in almost a kind of mirror world. I mean, here were these institutions, here were these artists, but they were not known outside. They had, at that time, very limited experience outside, and you were really invited into this family in a way, yeah?
Absolutely. I was treated as a, not as a tourist, but as a man, young conductor going there to try to make music, especially Italian music, of course, because Maestro Gergiev invited me just to go to just not to teach, but just to pass my experience on the Italian repertoire. Also because during my piano playing time, I worked very much with singers because I always been obsessed with voices. So I did many Liederabend, but also accompanying singers for operatic repertoire. And I attended also playing the piano some lessons, teaching of singing, which now is incredibly important for my work as an operatic conductor.
Right. We should say that when Gianandrea Noseda refers to the piano, each time he takes his fingers and it's as if he's playing the piano. And I think it's not only that you're Italian and therefore talk with your hands, because you're Northern Italian, so you don't talk with your hands as much as some, but I think it's because really, when you're thinking about these things, it's a part of you, yeah? And so
yeah,
when you're thinking about
it is
about
definitely, yeah, yeah. I cannot just reject, or I'm a conductor, just to be a purist. No, I was a piano player.
clearly. While you were in St. Petersburg, then, you must also have become more or increasingly exposed to the Russian repertoire. And I'm imagining that this fascination with the Rachmaninoff Symphony, which we should say you also have made a very noted recording on the Chandos label, with Isle of the Dead and...
Isle of the Dead, the Youth Symphony.
And the Youth Symphony, which is this movement written as a youth. It's not the title, really, that he gave it. And then the Symphony No. 1, fairly often now in history recorded piece, but rarely played piece. How did you first come to be involved in this search for the meaning of the First Symphony?
But you got absolutely the point before when you said I was little by little going, just diving inside the Russian repertoire, because of course, being principal guest conductor in the Mariinsky Theater, I had also to conduct Russian repertoire. That's why I started, of course, with the Queen of Spades. I did Betrothal in the Monastery, I did War and Peace, I did Boris, one of the milestones of the Russian repertoire. That has been the turning point when I decided to learn Russian as a language, because you cannot conduct Boris without understanding really the meaning of every single word. And starting from there, I also started to conduct Rachmaninoff Symphony No. 2, Rachmaninoff Symphony No. 3, Symphonic Dances, some of the Prokofiev symphonies. All have come together, no, in my life. And 3 years ago, I was in New York conducting at the Met the Forza del Destino, and a friend of mine just put on my attention a recording of Symphony No. 1, and another friend of mine gave me the score.
Coincidence,
in 3 days apart, no?
It was the force of destiny, right?
Possibly was the first, la forza del destino. And I started to listen to the recording. I looked at the score. I realized how beautiful music is in the First Symphony. And at that point, I decided to program this symphony with my orchestra in Manchester, with the BBC Philharmonic. After having played in concert, we decided right away, accordingly with Chandos, to do the recording. Also because the Rachmaninoff Foundation, which is held by the grandson of Sergei Rachmaninoff, Alexander Rachmaninoff, was very keen to support this revival, or let's say rebirth of Symphony
I think
No. 1.
Of the important goals, as I understand it, of the Sergei Rachmaninoff Foundation is to bring more attention to the lesser known works. It's not like Rachmaninoff needs help in letting people know that the Paganini variations exist or the third piano concerto exists, you know. But this was a man who composed throughout his life, and there are many works that are less known. So
absolutely, that is the major aim and goal for the Rachmaninoff Foundation, and that's why along the first symphony in the recording, there is the Isle of the Dead and the Youth Symphony, which is absolutely unknown. Just to put on the map,
right.
This is the Rachmaninoff, whatever, doesn't matter if you like or not like, but this is the music.
It's very, very important, yeah. You make it very clear in your performance and I'm sure in the preparation for that. And as you say, the musicians really have jumped in together with you, that you believe in this piece. And but you also believe that people who may not come out of the room saying, oh, it's my new favorite symphony, will now know more about Rachmaninoff's development, Rachmaninoff's decisions, the music that was in him at an early age. And this is something that's really important. Of course, we could just play 15 masterworks over and over, and we would get deeper and deeper if they were played well. But we also need to know the pieces that became unknown, sometimes accidentally and sometimes for reasons, but we need to know how they fit in, yeah?
I agree with you more than 100%, because I think just to approach Symphony No. 1 gives you and gives the audience, it gives the orchestra, a more complete point of view when they will go again to perform Rachmaninoff's Third Piano Concerto.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it gives to you more arrows, more keys to go deeply inside the music.
And it's like, interesting. Yeah. It's a coincidence, but they are this following week when we're speaking, really 2 days after, because you have a Tuesday, you have an extra concert. They will be doing the second concerto of Rachmaninoff with Kirill Gerstein and Charles Dutoit. And so I can't but imagine that these players are thinking differently with their fingers, with their heads, with their mouths as they're approaching a piece that they thought they know like the back of their hand.
That will be the most rewarding thing for me. If they just will play one more time the second piano concerto with a slightly different point of view. That would be the biggest goal and one of the reasons I just took this symphony to the Chicago Symphony and to the audience of Chicago.
Yes. You hear in Gianandrea Noseda's expression and in the content of what he's saying something that I have heard about him from a number of people in Europe, in Britain, and in the U.S., this tremendous level of sincerity. And that is something that's not easy to fake, especially in front of 115 often suspicious, cynical professional musicians. Or no, but in all seriousness, they know when somebody wants them to do something and why they want them to do it. And so if you come in there saying, as you said, I don't have the truth in my pocket, but we're all working towards something. Oh, okay, not this guy coming in. Well, you know, I've done the recording and I am the expert on this piece. And then they say, fine, you know, and I know how to play cards or something, right?
You know, show
it's
us.
It's not the way. Show, exactly. You have to show. You can't just get up and make a speech, even though I'm sure you gave them some interesting background about your researches. But you have to show. The speaking doesn't allow only for that. You worked, as you said, for the first time with a man who's a hero to so many in music, Radu Lupu. And our listeners might be intrigued to know that my guess is that your common language with Lupu, in addition to English, was Russian, because you, of course, learned Russian. And people forget that when Lupu was 15 or 16, he had done everything he could do in Romania, and his mother took him and he went for several years to study in Russia.
Correct. But we didn't, of course, I did know, but I don't want to impose a language. Usually, okay. Usually I react with the language the people is just talking to me. Mm-hmm. Of course, mm-hmm. in America is English, but someone, if someone knows I know Russian and they start to talk to me in Russian, I react in Russian. The same happens with French or Spanish, but mm-hmm. Usually I try to speak the language which is spoken in the country. Mm-hmm. So that came out after the first concert. So we were talking.
So you already had rehearsals.
We had rehearsals in English and with some Italians, because also Romanian Italians are very Latin languages. At the end of the performance, just naturally came out from my mouth, maladiec, which means bravo. He was shocked, but I didn't think I'm saying maladiec because I want him to talk to me in Russia. It was
natural.
Instead of bravo, I said maladiec. Immediately, he started to talk to me in Russian. So, Как ты знаешь русский? And from that point, we didn't stop. And, of course, for, let's say, official occasions, we still speak English,
yes,
between
right.
us.
Right.
But for other things, yeah. I think is nice to have this background taken
sure.
out from
and
ourselves.
Sure, it's nice to know that there are still accidental discoveries to be made about people, that that yeah. it wasn't a part of a plan or anything like that.
Yeah, that was a funny moment, just off stage.
I think people sometimes have ideas, or lack of ideas, really, about Lupu because of his decision many years ago that he wasn't going to concern himself with press, with interviews. And we had in this country quite a famous writer who just died at a very advanced age, J.D. Salinger, and he chose silence after 1963 or so. He published nothing. He gave no interviews. He lived. And so people decided, oh, he's crazy, he's a hermit. It turns out, now that he's dead, many people knew him. He lived his life and he did his work. But he didn't want this part of things. He wanted his privacy. And, you know, when I tell people, well, you know, I was talking to Radu Lupu, they say, Radu Lupu can talk? I said, well, of course he can talk. He speaks in many languages. He's interested in everything. He's extremely funny. He just, this is the publicity world is not his his world, but he has ideas, of course, about music, about collaboration, and it's nice to know that that's persisting with him.
yeah, and also this attitude, so pure, so honest, with music, is incredible in because comes out every single minute in his piano playing, and also his conception of Beethoven. Third piano concerto was for me like to open a window on the piece because
How so? Because
the idea of not maestoso, but just he doesn't lose the general line in playing. Mm-hmm. So when he starts from the first note, he knows all the journey. Without losing the impression he's improvising.
Exactly.
That is incredible because in any bar you think, oh, he improvised that. He just found now this, but he never loses the general line. It's a miracle. And the pureness of his approach to the music is so infecting, so mm-hmm. infected me, and I didn't have any problem to embrace this vision of Beethoven, which enriched a lot my knowledge of the piece.
When you play that piece or pieces from that period again, there's also something about him in that purity that he, who makes few expressions at his chair, he doesn't sit on a bench, but he often, you look at him and he seems, oh, it's quite wonderful what's happening. You know, he seems to take himself into the surprise, and a great joy follows from that. And I think that infects people as well.
You know what I really think belongs? It belongs to incredible great artists. The ability, the skill they have to be narrators.
Interesting.
To tell the story. We have many good musicians, but who is able to narrate, to be a narrator, to catch you like our grandfather, grandmother, when they are telling us story tales, just
yes,
you know, fairy tales.
Right.
Because they knew exactly when I was a child, my grandmother, the moment when the coup de théâtre, the surprise mm-hmm. should come, just to see the reaction in my eyes, and when just to leave this emotion, just to die away, and again another surprise. I think this ability, through the music, without forcing the music, because we don't want the music to tell what we want, but we have to let the music say what it should say to the audience. But the way we present to the audience, the way we tell the story is interesting.
Absolutely.
And sometimes doing nothing increases the tension, the expectation. And when you do just a small gesture is, oh, this is incredible. This is the biggest ever surprise I've ever experienced in this piece. So to be a narrator is something I try to discover and to achieve also in my conducting. And I have to say, most of the time, I don't get there. But
well, I think I
will
go
insist.
In that direction.
I will insist.
It's
can guarantee.
It's a very, very interesting insight generally. And I think it also is something, because it would have been very possible to play the Rachmaninoff, which, you know, it's not a perfect piece. It would have been very possible to play sections of it very well, but not to give it a feel of cohesion. And you gave it, you would say it's in the music, but you presented it with its stories and with its stories. So it's a very interesting insight. It's also interesting, too, how many very good musicians are very good storytellers. I mean, actually, off the podium. And some of them like to engage, you know, in kind of competition, as going back to Boccaccio or whatever. This is how storytelling really developed, you know. And if you have a chance sometime, if you are in a room with, say, Daniel Barenboim and James Levine, they will tell the stories like building a pyramid, you know, and who's going to put the next rock on the top, and enjoying it so much, though.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe it's because living and working with things that should tell a story rather than just should sound a certain way. That's very, very interesting. In terms of gesture, it's obvious in watching you on the podium that you have spent some time with Valery Gergiev. Doesn't mean by any means you are some kind of a clone. And I don't know if anybody can move the fingers individually quite the way he does. But you don't use a baton, and you are also quite tall. And so some of that maybe is just you need to reach to the people. But I'm curious, was it something that you found you were adopting some of these movements naturally? You were doing it by a decision. You found this was a way to communicate. It's what the musicians in Mariinsky were used to, or... Coincidence.
It's difficult to answer, Andrew, because when you are in your time of formation as a conductor, the most important thing for you, for yourself, is how to communicate through the gestures your musical ideas. That is the point. And my first teacher, Italian teacher, Donato Renzetti, incredibly talented conductor, was very focused on precision, technique, mm-hmm. how to show correctly everything.
The stick.
With the music, the stick, yeah. or without stick.
Okay.
But very, the precision right. of the movements, without losing the fire, the power of the performance.
But what a great person to start with, because
incredible.
You get this beaten into you in a way.
Absolutely incredible, because in my professional life, very... rarely I had a problem, oh, this one should be done in two, in eight, in six. So I know exactly how to approach technically a specific moment. But of course, later on when I got in contact with Valery Gergiev, 1 year later in Siena, in the same masterclass with Myung Woon Chung, was another way to add informations to my way of gestures, of course. And you know much better than I do, conductors with long arms are different from conductors with short arms.
That's very true.
Because for us, with long arms, is easier to conduct long lines, because our arms are waving in a way in that just accordingly with this music. But for the long arm conductor, what is... small precision, like, you know, the 3-8, 5-8, like this moment, very rhythmically unstable, like Rive to Spring, takes time to get confident with it. So, but I try to put all these informations together, and I try to look the conductors, to look Valery, of course, but to look Myung Chung, to look Maestro Muti, to look Claudio Abbado, and also to look the old conductors from the past. How? Not because I was interested... how they moved the hands,
right.
but how to convey.
Right. How do you have some favorites from the older generations?
Of course, there are some conductors very, very close to me. For instance, I really like Mitropoulos.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I really like Mitropoulos in his way, fierish way to convey ideas. Of course, there are many others. Toscanini, of course. How can I not mention Toscanini?
Yeah, you won't be allowed to go back to Italy if you don't mention
him. Absolutely. They will just stop me at the border going out. But I try to put all the information together and try to metabolize, mm-hmm. just to digest,
mm-hmm. yes.
and to try to find my way to express music. But if I see the way one of these conductors is able to show the legato lines, and I'm not able to get that result. I try not to imitate, but just try to understand why that gestures involve the orchestra at that level. They will play this fantastic silk legato.
Right.
Silk-like legato. Right. So all these informations come to your experience, mm-hmm. and you try to find out your style.
Sure.
I have to say also, sometimes I use the baton, mm-hmm. the stick. The reason is quite silly, I have to say, to admit. Sometimes when you just hold the stick and you feel, oh, what I do with that, that means it's something out of you. It's not mm-hmm. just the normal prolongation of, mm-hmm. of your arm. So mm-hmm. in that case, it's better don't use it. Mm-hmm. But if you just, before the concert, you take the baton in your hand, it's natural your way to deal with it.
Yes.
Probably I will go for the baton. Depends also on the repertoire, vocal repertoire, Verdi Requiem, Deutsch Requiem. I do for sure without baton.
Right, of course.
But other things, I let myself to be very free to make decision last second, let's say.
Right. Tell us about your theater and about your festival in Italy.
I took the position of artistic director, sounds important, of the Stresa Festival back in 2000. And the festival has a very important history because in the 2011 we will celebrate the 50th edition. So there is a long story with this festival. An old big name of the past, I can name Rubinstein, Oistrakh, Milstein, Giulini, the young Maestro Muti, Abbado. Everybody came to conduct in this festival. The festival went a little bit down during the 90s because of financial reasons. So when I took in 2000, was not very wealthy as a festival, but trying to invite colleagues which are very close to me and friends, I just try to re-energize the festival with the president, which is running the festival as a president, so as an administrator. Now we solve all the problems financially. So now the festival is still, is just reaching again the golden era, which mm-hmm. it was, no? It's supposed to be. So it's a festival in one of the most beautiful spots of nature, which is in the Lago Maggiore, north of Italy, very close where I live. And we make many concerts in different venues, so mm-hmm. churches, palazzi, castles, and we have also a symphony hall, auditorium. And so now I have to say important conductors, soloists, and artists are coming. I'm so pleased about that.
That's wonderful. It's a combination of orchestral music, chamber music, recital,
correct.
Vocal.
And also tourism, because mm-hmm. if one artist comes in the morning, he has the free morning, we can just take him or her to the island to visit the buildings, the Borromeo Islands. That has been my first, let's say, job I took with responsibility in Italy. The second is the Teatro Reggio,
right.
The Opera House, the TRT, as we call Teatro Reggio Torino.
This is also a house with a long history.
Absolutely.
Although
Toscanini
a new
was
building
the music
now, but
director.
Toscanini was the music director, right.
There, and La Bohème and Manolesco were premiered there. And the first Italian performance of Salome took place in Torino. And so Zandonai, Francesca da Rimini, was premiered in Torino. So it's an opera house with a lot of history. And in 2007, I took up the appointment of music director. And now I am in my third season. I have to say it's a very, very important opera house, also because the orchestra is, despite the fact we consider Italian orchestra not at the level of other international orchestras, I have to say the work we have done in the last 3 years put the orchestra in a very good conditions. The chorus mm-hmm. is spectacular. Mm-hmm. Always we can invite important soloists, important singers, of course, important conductors. And now also we try to attract very important directors, because mm-hmm. in the opera house you have also to deal with directors. It's not only the visual part of the opera is important. So and this summer in July and August, I will take for the first time ever the Teatro Regio Torino in a tour in Japan and China.
Mm-hmm.
We will...
What productions?
Two productions, La Bohème and Traviata.
Uh-huh.
And with also two symphonic gala concerts,
right,
let's say,
right,
with singers. Right. So it's a major project.
Absolutely.
And next season also, we will have a major tour in Spain, France, and Germany, always with Verdi. So we will play Verdi Requiem in Spain. We will play in France, in Paris, at Teatro Champs-Élysées, the four sacred songs by Verdi, and a big selection from Vesperi Siciliani. And we will also go to Germany to take our production of La Traviata. So I try to not to put on the European map the theater, because it has always been done, has always been there, but just to re-energize,
sure, sure,
and to really to give this energy and to show how can we produce performances of opera.
And you've also taken, or will take, the Metropolitan Opera to Japan, or you will join them. You may not carry them.
Bravo, bravo. No, I will join them. Is a big privilege to be the conductor with Jimmy Levine, and just joining this fantastic tour. So I will do Lucia di Lammermoor with the company in Japan, mm-hmm, next, mm-hmm, season. Yeah,
yeah, that's exciting. Yeah.
This is very exciting.
Yeah, yeah. On the one hand, Italians, of course, have given us opera, this rich, rich tradition, and we keep finding works that have been lost from the repertoire. Maestro Muti is doing Attila, the first time it's been done at the Metropolitan, though it was done in Chicago and it was done at New York City Opera. But still, there are pieces we don't all know. On the other hand, of course, and there's great pride in this, on the other hand, of course, an Italian conductor must be asked to do a lot of Italian work by other organizations. And how do you find that balance between Viva Italia and, you know, I also conduct the rest of the repertoire?
It's a very interesting question, because, of course, there is still the habit to consider Russian music should be only taken by Russians, and Italian is not like it used to be. But still,
it still persists.
It still persists. So what I like to do is, of course, I cannot deny I am Italian. I grew up with the operatic repertoire.
Right.
But what I'm doing also in my cooperation with my work with the BBC Philharmonic is also to try to find very beautiful, interestingly written symphonic repertoire in the 20th century written by Italians like Dalla Piccola, like Casella, like Volferrari, like Petrassi, mm-hmm, like Maderna, mm-hmm, Castiglioni. Mm-hmm. So there are, I'm trying also to present Italian repertoire out of the operatic,
right,
repertoire,
right,
which is
an right,
important thing.
There is, as you say, I mean, that list is only the beginning. Then you go to Berio, to Nono. I mean, Italy has produced so many wonderful composers across the styles and across the types of music. And also, of course, continually, fortunately, the wonderful orchestral conductors, even though historically it's not been said to have the greatest symphonic orchestra traditions. But many are working on that. You are doing with your festival and with Torino. Maestro Muti has the Juvenile Orchestra, Luigi Cherubini, and there are many of these projects now. I mean, it must be going on, and Abbado has orchestras. They must be going on throughout the country. And some of it also probably is some of this habit or myth that the French do this, the Italians do this. And I think as we see more, I mean, one of the great things to me about the influence of the American orchestra is not a sound, but it is a reminder to the rest of the world that if you have an audition that's open and blind and behind the screen, the players could come from Hungary, from Japan, from Mongolia. You know, everybody doesn't have to come from one nation or one place if you're going for that quality. And you're slowly seeing this in some of the more traditional European countries, I would say. And I think that's a reminder, though, too, to those young players, gosh, you know, I could play here, but maybe I can also play in Berlin or I can play in the United States.
Absolutely. I think is a key point. So it's important. What is incredible in the American orchestras, and now referring to the Chicago experience, which I just had, is the fact, not only the particular sound of the Chicago Symphony, but the right sound the artist of the Chicago Symphony can use for a particular repertoire. That is, I cannot say the biggest quality is to be chameleontic, but you have to adjust to be able to adjust your style of playing to the repertoire you are presenting.
There's a difference between being a chameleon and having empathy and having an understanding of how to transform something, because a chameleon just blends in and copies in a way.
No. You have really to believe in what we are doing. So that's why the quality of talking to the Chicago Symphony is so well recognized in the world. But also, you know, I've been lucky in my professional experience, because spending 3 months a year for 7 years in St. Petersburg, working in the theater, gave me, I repeat, the keys to go deeply inside the Russian repertoire. So when I just presented Symphony No. 1, Rachmaninoff, I felt very confident in trying to bring something very close to my heart, which I'm supposed to know. And also my experience with the British Orchestra. Just try also to approach Britten, to approach Vaughan Williams, to approach Elgar. It's very important, yeah. Because it gave me other possibilities, right. Other elements I can put in my general recipe of making music.
Right. And this all goes back to your earliest days when this is what you wanted to do, find a way to make music.
Yeah, absolutely. What is important for me is try to solve the sort it out the way to solve the enigma, which is in the music.
Gian Andrea Noseda, thank you so much for sharing your perspectives on the enigma and for being so open with us about your views and your experiences. And I hope this will just be the first of many visits to Chicago and many opportunities for us to talk about music and life. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Spiace all'onda d'arte a me che non
We heard music this evening conducted by our guest, Gian Andrea Noseda. To open, we heard the first movement in its entirety of Rachmaninoff's First Symphony from 1895, that from a recent recording on the Chandos label made possible by the Serge Rachmaninoff Foundation. And to close, we heard from Anna Netrebko's first solo disc and first Deutsche Grammophon disc, Gian Andrea Noseda conducting the Vienna Philharmonic, with Miss Netrebko singing Donna Anna's Non Mi Dir from Mozart's Don Giovanni. We'd like to thank Phil Grabsky, maker of In Search of Beethoven, and Rochelle Rowe of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra Association for bringing Gian Andrea Noseda to our attention initially. We'd like to thank Matt DeStefano for making this program sound great. We'd like to thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation, and other friends of this program. Let us know what you thought of tonight's program or any of our other programs. Drop us a line at Rentap, Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P, at AOL.com. And speaking of the Internet, visit us there at WFMT.com/critical thinking. Where you can experience the always free and internationally downloaded Critical Thinking podcast. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.
So when you become Pope, you can revert to the Latin name, you know?
I will never become a Pope.